And welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all of those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the actors, the cinematographers, the production designers, the costume designers, the film editors, the sound editors, sound mixers, composers, those masterful VFX artisans and gurus. You name it, we talk to all of them. And I've been doing more talking with people. And hopefully you're going to hear two of my pre-recorded interviews today, as well as we've got a great filmmaker joining us, a director, Jeff Celentano, to talk about his new film, Blackwater Lane, psychological thriller, elements of crime factored in there, a slight tinge of horror that fits well with psychological thriller, practical effects. It's very Hitchcockian, and it's based on the best-selling book by B.A. Paris, Blackwater Lane. I have read the book when it came out some time ago. So I'm always curious when I read a book to see what the cinematic adaptation is. And I am very impressed with what Jeff has done bringing Blackwater Lane to life on the screen. For those of you who are fans of the book, I encourage you, see the film. It's currently available. It's on streaming platforms. It's on VOD, including Spectrum, which sometimes is behind the times. But it is really well done. And the fact that with just a few tweaks, it really does stay true to the novel. So I can't wait to talk with Jeff because there's so many fun elements in this film from a filmmaking standpoint that I want to talk to him about. But also, you know, really bad week for Hollywood this past week. Pam is sitting in, she's sitting in the booth and just like, and her eyes popped up. She looked up from playing her game on her phone. And we lost Shelley Duvall. Everybody knows Shelley Duvall from The Shining, from Popeye, but my favorite productions that were, she not only starred in along with others, but she was the creative mind behind them, Fairy Tale Theater. Just wonderful, wonderful series, of live action fairy tale. We lost her. Richard Simmons, the indefatigable. You know, he's been missing out of the public eye for a while. He recently came back in on social media, doing a lot of Twitter posts and whatnot. We lost Richard. Richard Simmons was a personality larger than life. I first became aware of Richard Simmons thanks to General Hospital. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, when he introduced a fitness craze in Port Charles, and everybody was taking his fitness classes. Well, that fitness craze spilled over into real life. And eventually, you know, Richard had his own talk show. He then did his, you know, multi-million copy selling video workout videos, Sweating to the Oldies, and popped up everywhere. I had the pleasure of meeting him on multiple occasions and speaking with him, and he was always just a delight. You could not walk away from Richard without having a smile on your face. So, sad news with Richard's passing. Then Shannon Daugherty. She has been battling cancer of various types since 2015. She was in remission, came back, spread to her brain, into her bones, and we just lost her. such a force. And the way she battled and publicly battled and spoke about cancer and spoke about her journey and really everything that you had heard about her over the years being difficult in productions on Charmed, on 90210, and other things, all of that she really put to rest with her outreach and her podcasts over the past couple of years. So that just another gone too soon tragedy. And then late yesterday, another General Hospital alum that a lot of people aren't old enough to remember, James B. Seeking. He passed away at 90 from complications of dementia. But I think everybody knows him best from Hill Street Blues or as Doogie Howser's father on Doogie Howser. What an incredible career Seeking had on stage, on screen, big screen, little screen. Just, this has just been... And then we had some songwriters pass away as well. What, David Greenwood? Oh, Dave Loggins. He passed away. Somebody from the Oak Ridge Boys passed away. This past week has been hell on earth. And, of course, mixed in there, we had the... Huh? Who? Oh! Ah, and Pam just reminded me. Dr. Ruth! How could I forget Dr. Ruth? We lost her as well. This, and then, to have the whole shooting at the Trump rally on Saturday, just, this has been a hell of a week. I don't think we can go through another week like this. So let's hope that things turn the tide. And one of the ways to get out of a funk when all of these deaths happen is turning to entertainment, turning to music, turning to movies. And a lot of good ones, a lot of good movies out there. If you haven't seen it yet, it just opened on Friday. Fly Me to the Moon. For all you NASA geeks out there, I think you will appreciate the lightheartedness of this rom-com. Channing Tatum, Scarlett Johansson, Woody Harrelson. It is such a fun movie. And I just encourage you to see it. It's light, it's bright, it's breezy, it's fun. And entertaining. Entertaining as can be. And of course, Minions. We got Minions back for the fourth time. Okay, Pam's got thumbs up in the booth about Minions. I like Minions too. But they have definitely, Minions, this is now 4th of July weekend, which is when the film opened. So they had a huge holdover for a second week. Minions are the true 4th of July champions, it seems, franchise champions. Consistently, 4th of July weekends, when a new Minions film comes out. Did you, all of the four Minion films together thus far, largest grossing animation franchise, $5 billion. $5 billion. The Minions franchise has brought in at the box office. So, everybody likes the little yellow things that can't speak. So, but get yourself out to it. Plus, there's free air conditioning in the movie theater. But moving on with our show today, in addition to Jeff Celentano joining us at the midpoint of the show, two pre-recorded interviews. I hope I can get to both today. We're going to start with one that I dearly love, Eric Roberts. I've waited 42 years, over 42 years, to interview Eric. Finally, we got to, for a very brief 10 minutes, because his schedule was so limited. I hope you guys, he's going for the Guinness Book of World Records here, with how many films and appearances, TV shows he's been in. Right now, he's sitting at 820 roles, according to his IMDb. So I think he's got enough in him to get at least another 180 roles there and at least top out 1,000 performances to his credit. The film is called Lumina. It is a sci-fi thrill ride that follows four friends who are searching for a missing friend who was abducted by aliens. And she apparently is now being hidden in a DUMB. I kid you not, D-U-M-B, which is an acronym for Deep Underground Military Base. So, they are desperate to find her. And what they do find, they head to the desert, and they meet up with a character named Tom, who is played by Eric Roberts. Now, the film Lumina, it has, I'm not going to kid you, it has some issues, written and directed by Gino McCoy. It's his first feature. The premise is really good. Some of the casting choices fall short. One in particular, the alien effects, the creature effects, are fantastic, even though they do resemble a lot of Alien, Alien and Aliens, Sigourney Weaver. But you get a standout performance from a supporting player, Ken Lawson, who energizes and elevates and really saves a lot of the film. Once he appears on screen, he really buoys what has dragged you down. But the linchpin in this entire film is Eric Roberts. He's in one extended scene, people. But as Tom, he is the one who provides, he gives us the history. He gives us the story. He fills us in on the gaps that up to the point of his appearance on screen, you're really kind of wondering what the heck is going on. So, Eric fills that in perfectly. His cadence, his dialogue delivery is delicious. His costuming, kudos to costuming and the production design of the set that he has for his quote-unquote compound. Absolutely outstanding. Shot on location in Marrakesh. And as you'll hear Eric talk about, it was his first time shooting there. He's in love with it and the people there. But Eric really elevates the film and truly points us as viewers in the direction of where our thoughts should be going and the options for how this might play out. He cuts through the smoke and cuts through the empty spots as Tom. Just fabulous. Lumina is out now. I recommend seeing it. I would not pay full price. I'd go to a matinee price or watch it digitally. But it's definitely, it shows a lot of future potential for Gino McCoy. And, you know, as I said, you've got a great standout supporting performance from Ken Lawson. And we've got some holes that happen in here, but the effects, the creature creations, Ken's performance, and Eric's, and that really buoys Gino's concept. So, instead of me prattling, take a listen to my exclusive, albeit short, 10-minute, 8-second interview with Eric Roberts talking Lumina. How are you?
I'm great, Debbie. Thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm thrilled after 42 years finally getting to speak with you.
You waited 42 years to speak with me?
My entire career as a critic, I have waited to speak with you. So
it's so patient of you, and I'm so flattered. Thank you.
Well, I have just admired everything you've done. I love, and the fact you've only been in 820 films and shows so far in your career, I'm waiting to see you hit 1,000.
Oh.
Get you in the Guinness Book then.
I have to say, the appearances that you have in everything, I love how you select roles, especially the past few years. You get in, you get out, but you always pick a character that is key in some manner to the story. It's not a throwaway character. And that's exactly what Tom is here in Lumina. You were a breath of fresh air to me in this film when you appeared on screen. And the dialogue that you have and the importance that you have in defining this story for the audience, I cannot underscore how fantastic that is.
That is so nice of you, doll. Tom, being a former government employee, he's a very bright, he's probably top of his class. But what I like best about this guy is, as smart as he always has been, he knows where all the economic bodies are buried.
Mm-hmm.
He knows where we can trace back all the understanding of why we want to understand alienation, as it were. And you know, he's not a soft banana, but he is a bit of a showboat. So we don't know, if we're a white collar guy, we don't know if we trust this kind of guy. But he's also a white collar guy incognito, so it is what it is.
Yeah, and just watching you is really a master class in a meld of cadence and delivery and physical expression. And we really see that here in the costume that you have. Really helps fuel this character and your performance, the way you wear the hat and the way that you pull it down in the front and you give this glare or this look that it can be interpreted many ways. How important in a role like Tom is the costume? Because it seems like you really wore that costume. It's not a costume that wore you.
You're 100% right. And if you have a really good designer and you have a really cool character, they're going to always meld beautifully. But if you don't, they won't. So it takes this costume was 30% of this guy's whole presentation, because the hat, the coat, that was my whole look, that whole presentation. Here I am. I am Tom. It made me feel I was halfway home once I got dressed every day. That is true. He was a lot of the character, how he looked. Just how he sounded also was a part of that look, you know?
And that's something that you also do so well, is within the cadence of your voice, you bring so much dimension and emotionality to characters, such as with Tom, and we really feel his attitude and also the arrogance and possibly the ambiguity behind it as well. And it really, I cannot stress this enough. And I even emailed the publicist after I screened the film, I guess about a month ago, that your performance is the linchpin in this film. Without you,
that's so kind of you, Debbie. Thank you,
Eric. Without you in this role, we would not learn. We would not understand, because it's very hazy and fuzzy with this group as to what they want, what they understand, what they think. Are they tripping out? There's jealousy among them. We need somebody with clarity of vision to point us and the film in a direction it needs to go. And that's exactly what Tom does. And I think in less skilled character hands, it would not be as effective as it is with you.
Wow, that is so kind of you. Thank you so much. I love those kind words. Thank you.
Well, and everybody will tell you, Eric, that if I thought you sucked, I would tell you that too. So,
okay.
Now, do you have the benefit of going to Marrakesh for filming, or was your stuff shot here in the States, or?
No, I got to go. It was cool.
Oh my!
Yeah, it was a little bit of a Hollywood luxury. So I was on a plane to Marrakesh, and it was ridiculously fun.
Wow. Well, also, Well, they also put you in a really cool set. The production design of Tom's Compound. Very cool. You've got practical stuff there. You've got, obviously, some CGI effects thrown in there. But that had to be, like, playtime at moments for you walking in there.
It was a playground. But what was even nicer about it were the people there. They were so welcoming, so approachable. And they love American movies.
Well, you can't ask for more than that.
Yeah, it's neat. They all asked after my wife. They all asked after my sister. They all asked after my daughter. It was lovely, and they were like old peeps. They were such a cool society there.
Now, was this the first time that you've shot in Morocco or Marrakesh?
I've been to Morocco a couple of times. Once I did. Still photos for a magazine there, but no, that's my first shooting there. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, it was really neat. The infrastructure there is really cool for movies. They have a police unit for movies. I mean, it's kind of very America. You know, it's cool.
Wow. So I'm curious, Eric, at this stage of your career. With the vast number of roles and different types of roles that you have played, what is it that you look for when a script comes to your desk? Here you've got Gino as a writer-director. This is his first narrative feature film that he's directing. What speaks to you and makes you say yes to a role? Is it on the page? Is it the director? What is that process for you?
Well, to be really blatantly honest with you, it's a little bit different every project just because of that day of the week, how we got it, who we got it, blah, blah, blah. But my little factory at home is this. I have these two readers who read all the scripts. They write synopsises. I read the synopsis. If I like a synopsis, I will then read the script. If I like the script, I will tell my wife, make the deal. My wife is the boss. My wife runs the show. And we also have an agent, Peter Young, and because you have to have an agent in order to have a contract. It's just how the union is built business wise. So she works through this agent, and I say yes to projects sometimes just based solely on the character, sometimes based solely on the director. Sometimes based solely on the fact it's a student film with a really good script that I think can really start somebody's own career, and my wife's going to talk to them and loves them as a person. So Eric will make this movie. Sometimes it's just they call me like for Sly's Expendables. Hey Eric, come be my bad guy. Okay, and you know it all depends on what it is and how it comes about. And sometimes it's, what is this script? I said, we don't know. It just got sent to us. Well, it's just fantastic. Sometimes we get these big money offers that are terrible, and I have to say no.
Yeah.
So it's always a variable, and it's always fun, and it's always like it's always in school at its best.
One last question then for you, Eric. What was it about Lumina that made you say yes to this script, to this film?
There are aliens, and we all have to study it more and accept it more. They are, if not among us, they're out there.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree with you more. Eric, this has been so lovely to get to speak with you, and I hope we get to do it again in the future.
I do, too. All my love and respect, though.
Oh, thanks so much, Eric. You have a great holiday weekend.
Thank you.
And that was my little exclusive with Eric Roberts talking about Lumina. And yes, there are aliens. Either among us or on the way. Of course, if you knew certain members of my family, you would say, yeah, they're already here. So Lumina, check it out. As I said, you know, It's got some great creature creation, great aliens, nice special effects, some really good performances from a few people, and Eric just soars in this particular one. And I see a lot of potential here for bigger storytelling for Geno McCoy. This was his first feature. He's done a short, a video, but this kind of, he jumped in with both feet to do this one. So here's to seeing what he comes up with next. So, all right, Pam, what should we do? We've got Jeff calling in about 5 minutes. We should do, okay. All right. So, if we have to stop it, we'll stop it and then pick it up at the end. But let's shift gears here and talk about The Convert. What a beautiful, beautiful film. Powerful, riveting, thought-provoking, period piece. Directed by the incredible Lee Tamahori. Action, it's a historical epic. Stars Guy Pearce. He plays Thomas Monroe, a lay preacher, who arrives in a colonial town in the early 19th century New Zealand. The Brits are trying to colonize New Zealand, which at that point, the only people who inhabited New Zealand were two Maori tribes. The Maori are native to New Zealand and some of the other areas down there in the South Pacific. And the film, as we dive into this film, let me pull up my notes here because I actually took lots of notes here. Written by Michael Bennett, Shane Danielson, and Lee Tamahori. Now, Lee, I have loved as a director for a long time. The Devil's Double, Die Another Day, a James Bond film with Pierce Brosnan, next with Nicolas Cage. He knows pacing, he knows drama, he knows action, he knows how to build tension. But he also knows how to bring very introspective characters to life. And that's what he does here with The Convert and with Guy's character of Thomas Monroe. As we explore faith, transformation, violence, the film is very visceral. But it's also, it's so authentic. Shot on location, in New Zealand. Many of the actors are Maori. Just outstanding. And watching Guy's character is amazing. As you see, he is a fish out of water as he comes to this new world. And it's a clash and a crossing of cultures. It's very observational. We are in Thomas Monroe's shoes. We see everything through his eyes. We feel the time and place, thanks to the location, thanks to stunning cinematography by Jin Lone. And then you pair Guy with playing opposite a native Maori girl who is put in his charge by her father, who is the leader of one of the warring Maori tribes, Te Oriori. Nakatai Melbourne plays Ranjamai. Te Oriori is a breakout actress. I cannot wait to see more of what she does in the future. She goes toe-to-toe with Guy. He more or less, his character, Thomas, mentors her. There's also a woman, Charlotte, played by Jacqueline McKenzie, who has been embedded in the community for quite a while. She speaks Maori. She serves as a translator. And she's very, very protective of Ranjamai, which is Teoriori's character. And to watch this as an outsider through the eyes of Thomas Monroe is just so absorbing. It is truly an experience watching this film. And having given you that great lead up, and we will come back to The Convert and my interview with Guy, but now I'm going to change it up on you and I'm going to switch gears because we've got Jeff Celentano on the line. So I'm going to bring Jeff on now. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, my dear. It's a little bit hard to hear you.
Uh-oh. Hard to hear?
There you go. Now I got you.
That better? Okay, Pam's pushing dials and things. Blackwater Lane. I got to tell you, Jeff, I read the book when it came out. B.A. Paris's book. So I was looking forward to this. As I said at the top of the show today, I love to be able to see a film when I've read the book. Because when you read a book, you have everything imagined in your head. The descriptive nature, the words, the sounds that are described on the page. You've got a running cinema in your head as you're reading something. At least I do. And
sure.
With very rare exceptions, one of the only books I ever read where everything that I imagined in my head, saw in my head, I saw on screen when the film was made, was Thomas Harris's Silence of the Lambs. That is probably the most perfect adaptation I have ever seen from book to screen.
I'd have to agree with you on that one.
Yeah. There have been a few others that have come close, but nothing like that. Blackwater Lane, you come damn close, Jeff.
That's good.
Everything that I saw and heard in my mind's eye, you delivered on screen. You've got a few minor changes, which work because of the actors that you have. We're set in Britain, but instead of having British characters, we now have our main characters as being American expats. That works fine.
Right.
That's minor. That's a throwaway. That's a no-brainer. But in order to get people like Minka Kelly, Dermot Mulroney, Maggie Grace, you're going to make that little shift. And I think every moviegoer who has read the book is going to say, oh, yeah, that works. That works really well.
Oh, I hope so. That was a worry of mine.
I think it works great. I didn't give it second thought, Jeff.
That's fantastic to hear, I got to tell you. Let me just put my speakerphone on because my headphones are not. They're giving me an echo.
Uh-oh.
There. I think that's a little bit.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
All right.
I still got an echo.
Uh-oh.
Really weird. Everything I say repeats back to me.
Uh-oh. Well, I know nothing's repeating on our end or going out live echoing. Hmm.
It's like it happens sometimes, very rare, but...
It happens.
It's doing it now.
Uh-oh. Well, let's see if we can get through this then without too much interference on your end.
No worries.
How did this story come to you? The script is written by Elizabeth Fowler. Had you read the book first and sourced this out, looked for
it? No.
Tell me how this came to you.
I just finished... Wow, it's so hard to do with this echo, because every time I speak, it repeats it right back to me. It seems to have stopped now. Okay, perfect. Moving on past that. So I had just finished The Hill with my producing partner, Warren Ostergaard, and he said he has a person he knows in the business, Liz Fowler. She has this project. We should look at it. And so I'm always trying to... I used to always be the kind of director that wanted to become somebody that was extremely versatile, that the studio couldn't put into a box. It's not really the way the studios work. They don't like you when you do that. But I was kind of a rebel in my younger days of filmmaking. I'm a little bit more savvy now and understand that I got to kind of stay in my lane a little bit. But I just stepped out after The Hill. I stepped out to do this little movie in between another picture I had. And I read the script. I liked it. I read the book. I liked it. I thought I could make this into a really scary movie. I could make it, I felt scarier than the book. I mean, more intense. Because you put it into a 2-hour window, mm-hmm. or an hour and a half window. And so I just wanted to do it for the challenge. And then I was told we had to make it in America, and we were looking at Georgia. And then all of a sudden I said, we even looked at Iceland at one time. And I said, why don't we go to England where the book takes place? So everybody kind of went, that's a great idea. So we started looking into the expense of that, because we originally nobody wanted to do that because we thought it was too expensive. And when we got to, you know, break it all down in England and look at all the different, you know, costs and tax credits and things like that, it just made sense. So I searched nonstop for that house in the movie. My location guy, when I got to England, disappeared. And I had no location person. So myself, my DP, and my wife got a car that we rented ourselves and couldn't wait anymore. We got tired of waiting for someone to help us. And we just got in the car and started searching the entire, that part of the country that we shot in, Essex. And we shot near the city of Norwich. And we found this incredible mansion. And as I was driving down the road to go into the property, I said to everybody, turn around. Turn around to my DP. Let's get out of here. This is ridiculous. This place looks like Remains of the Day or Downton Abbey. I mean, nobody's going to buy that this is a couple that inherited a house, you know. And they said, no, Jeff, you know how it is. You got to go in and look at it. Just go in. So I said, okay, this is ridiculous, but I'll go in. And as I walked in the front door, I couldn't believe it. The whole house was kind of designed modernly, more contemporary. Because these two guys that lived there were, you know, one was a designer and the other was a lawyer, and they were very, you know, prominent kind of people and very classy and good taste. And I said, wow, how come nobody's ever shot here? And they said, for the exact reason that you want to shoot here. They thought the inside would match the outside, but it didn't. So they didn't want to shoot here. They wanted to shoot a more gothic kind of house. But you wanted the more contemporary inside, but the outside to be, you know, grand. And that house was built in the 1500s, and no wow. movie had ever shot there. I think a Marvel movie was looking at it once, but they turned it down. So to end that whole conversation, if you're still with me, I wanted to say that the grand room you walk into was gothic, and I didn't like it, so we covered it with plastic, and that was the renovation room, which we needed anyway. So the house just was picture perfect.
Oh my God. And that cuts down.
So that's how it all ended.
And that cuts down on your production design budget.
Oh yeah, because even the two guys that lived in the house helped us with production design. I mean, I would need, like, I didn't like some of the sets that the production designer did at certain points, and I would go, this isn't working for me. And then the guy that owned the house is like, I got an idea. Let me go bring some things in. And he would bring these pieces of art in, and I'd be like, oh, you're hired.
Well, I have to say, the interiors are apportioned beautifully. The set dress is really beautifully done, but I love the design, the structural design within the house, and such as the kitchen, the living room, and of course our plasticed off renovation room.
Yeah,
but I love it all because it also gives you and your cinematographer, Felix Kramer, it gives you so much to work with in terms of the cinematography, the lighting and the lensing, because Felix could really get in there with the way the furniture is placed, with the doorways, the hallway, and really build upon sparser lighting, using negative space, which is used beautifully, creating some inky, delicious, inky blue-black darkness that works so well when the lights go out. Just fabulous for giving us that creepy thriller vibe. You know, is our poor heroine played by Minka Kelly. Is Cass going crazy? Is she a nut job? Are there are there things really happening in the house?
Yeah, I had someone in the beginning of the film when I was looking for a composer. I had a composer watch the film in the rough cut version, and he said to me, "Jeff, you really got me, man." I was on the edge of my seat the whole time, and then I thought the movie was about mental illness. I thought it was about somebody who was going senile, who was losing their mind, and I never knew what they were seeing was real or not real, but I actually believed it was not real. It was in her head, because I really thought you were making a movie about mental illness. And then when, and then comes to the end, right before the big twist, when she does something, I can't talk about it, I don't want to ruin it, but when she does something, he said, "Oh my God, this really is about mental illness, and she's, you know, done this thing." And then he twisted on me, and I found out that is not the movie I've been watching. You really blew me away. So that was a good achievement. Look, I mean, I you know, no apologies here or anything, and I'm really glad you loved it. I wish I had a little more time. We ended up getting a few of our days cut due to financing, and we ended up having a very short schedule with no time to do much. And thank God I've been in the business most of my life and made movies since 1994 as a director. I've done enough movies to know how to make things work in a quick way and also make them big and look expensive. And so that's all I focused on, was making sure the acting was fantastic. There's some things about the film I'm not, you know, myself happy with in certain ways, just because of time. It doesn't allow you to do those things. I don't know if other people notice the things that I notice, but, you know, I'm a perfectionist, so it's hard for me to love everything that I do, you know, unfortunately. But I think it came out good. I mean, people seem to really like it. There was some sound work done that I wasn't a part of that, you know, I'm not 100% excited about, but you probably know what I'm talking about in certain places.
I do.
But yeah, but that was not me. I just want to say that, you know, overall, I'm really happy with the film, how it turned out for the time we had and the financing we had. But yeah, I mean, I would love to make another one like it, that's for sure.
Now, were you shooting night for night, day for night? Because a lot of this takes place at night. Some of the key aspects of the film take place at night. So, and
yeah,
night
we,
shoots.
We never did day for night. We shot nights and we shot days. And my AD that I brought with me, he's a genius. He's amazing at flipping schedules and keeping everything within the union rules for SAG and the DGA, and he's just an amazing guy. And without him, it would have never happened. No way.
Now, when you sat down with your DP, with Felix Kramer, were you guys shot listing and storyboarding a combination?
Yes.
And either or both? I figured you probably were, because of the very nature of the images and what's happening, particularly inside the house. Because you really need to have a feel. You've got to have something concrete to go on, especially when you're on a tight budget.
I work off of painters, not photographers mostly. I mean, sometimes I use photography, but I always find a painter that has the look I want, and I kind of study their paintings. And so Magritte was a painter of Spain that I really loved, and I brought that into Felix, and we looked at it. And Magritte has a tendency to paint like a house that you look at, and it looks like it's night, but above the rooftop, it's daytime with the sun and clouds, but you can't notice it right away because you're looking at this picture, it looks like nighttime, but then when you look up, you're like, wait a minute, the sun's out. So it was really different, and he loved the color and the look of his paintings, and so that's what we went for. And then we did look at some other films and some things like that along the way to kind of find the right color palette. So I'm all about tone in movies. Color and feel and look and everything is really important to keep a consistent tone.
Yeah, and the tone is so important in this film. And the ambient color palette defines that. And I love the palette that you came up with. And so much of that is affected then by the lighting, which is very creative in so many instances within the house. I really am very impressed with the lighting that Felix and you designed. Really wonderful.
Yeah, he's a very talented guy. I mean, I love Felix. We were lucky to have him. I mean, he went above and beyond in so many ways. He felt that we needed a drone in certain scenes, and he felt that we needed another kind of camera that we didn't even wasn't even on the market previous to us, about a month only. And he said, "I own those cameras. I own the drones, and I own this special little mini camera, the one that he used it to go up the staircase in the beginning. It's like a Steadicam, but it's very tiny, and it moves really, really fast and very stable." He flew all the way to Germany, where he lives, when we were prepping, and drove back in a van from Germany to England with his equipment and gave that to me on the house.
Wow.
That's the kind of guy he is. He said, "Look, I have enough money in the bank. I make enough money. I'm a very busy DP. And, you know, I'm on a Disney series after this, Disney Plus, for about 9 months. I want us to have the best looking movies, Jeff. So I'm going to bring that to you." And of course, we paid him for going there in the van and all that stuff. But he didn't charge us for any of his equipment or his time on the weekends on our days off, because we didn't have much time. We only had like a 20-day schedule.
Wow.
We went out and shot on our days off.
Oh, my God. Well, I have to say, you know, one of the early scenes in the film is on Blackwater Lane, middle of a storm. It's raining. It's dark. You've got people in dark-colored vehicles, black vehicles. There's no streetlights. And yet we have so much depth and texture. And it just sends chills up and down your spine watching this, because it's so foreboding as to what is going to happen. What are we going to see? And you move us
along.
That
was the idea.
Just such a great setup. But what you do, though, is you keep turning on a dime throughout this film, and you give us lots of false leads, false breadcrumbs. You create a lot of ambiguity. So for anybody that is paying attention watching this film, your wheels are going to start turning as to, now, wait a minute. This person doesn't seem too trustworthy. This one's being overly nice. And you know, you really make us think and wonder, like a great Hitchcockian film. This, I got the same feelings, very similar to what Hitchcock did with Suspicion.
Oh, wow, that's a major compliment. I don't know if I could even thank you for that, but I thank you for that. I mean, that's just really sweet of you to say.
Because you...
That was my intention. I did want to have the audience, you know, wondering who did what, but most people kind of in their mind tell me that they kind of think they know who's behind it or who's not behind it, or they kind of figured it out. But then the very end, they're like completely blown away, because that's not really what I was going for. I wasn't going for a situation where you 100% knew who was the, you know, antagonist in the film. You didn't know 100%, but you can kind of guess, which I love. It keeps the movie moving forward. But then, at the very end, the twist is so different that that's really what the movie's about. It's not about a whodunit movie. It's more about what's really going on here.
Mm-hmm.
That was my goal, and so I don't mind when people tell me, "Hey, I knew it was so and so, or I knew it was this." I said, "That's fine, but did you know the end was going to turn out that way?" No, I had no idea. That knocked me out of my chair. I said,
well,
okay, that's what excited me about this movie. To be honest with you, from day one, was the twist at the end. I loved it. I thought it was so unusual.
The twist at the end, the ultimate twist at the end.
Because, that's what I mean, yeah.
Because for people that haven't been able to put it together, like I had already figured out before we got midway in the film, people that were involved. That was obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, because I don't trust people. So, therefore, I look at every character very suspiciously. So I already figured out parts of this, but the ultimate twist at the end, I did not see that one. That was one of the greatest reveals of a twist. And I love it. I love it.
I'm glad. I really am. I've always wanted to I've always wanted to have a movie with that, a twist that like that. There was a film that I saw years ago that I was in love with called La Femme Nikita. Mm-hmm. And in that movie, they take a girl who's a vicious, horrible thief slash murderess, and the French government trains her to be a hired killer. And they train her for like 5 years. And her trainer, she falls in love with him. And he doesn't ever show her that he's in love with her, but he kind of insinuates it. You know, they never get together. And one night, he says, I'm taking you out into the real world tonight for dinner to celebrate. And she's so excited because, you know, she's finally going out with this guy. She's in love with him. He's her boss and her trainer. And they go to this beautiful restaurant. They give her this beautiful dress. She looks amazing. He's all dressed up in a suit. They get to the table, and he opens this. He gives her a box wrapped up. And she just starts crying. And she opens the box, and she lifts up the top. And I don't know if you remember this film, but mm-hmm. in it is a huge gold gun. And he says, you're going to get up. You're going to walk across the restaurant to that man in that table over there. You're going to shoot everybody at the table. Then you're going to run in the back to the toilets. You're going to climb out the window, and I'll pick you up in the alley. I mean, you are like far left turn from what you were just watching.
Yeah.
And that blew me away. And I always wanted to do a film that had a twist similar to that. And I feel Blackwater Lane has something not as, obviously not as amazing, but pretty unusual.
It's very unusual. Now, to pull all of this off as successfully as you have, once you have all your footage there, you've got some really knockout performances. And Dara, I love Natalie Simpson, who plays the detective, D.C. Lawson. She is wonderful. And she adds so much ambiguity, of course, trying to be, objective and not jump to any conclusions. But you're looking at her face, and she has such great facial expressions. Out of her mouth can be coming, no, no, I believe you, I hear you. And on her face, it's like, oh my God, no, no. You know, you're just...
Well, you really did watch the movie.
You know, you're off the reservation. And, you know, we get a great performance from Alan Caton as John Collins, Cass's BFF. And you let that character throw in some ambiguity. And then a real standout is Judah Cousin as our lovelorn student in love with his teacher, Cass. Yeah, you know, you got to have one of those.
You got to have one. Yeah.
But he is adorable. But he has a little creepiness to him, like a stalkery creepiness. Like when
when he walked in the room, I saw it right away. I said, this is the kid. He just has that ability. Look, there wasn't a lot of kids that were, at that time, there was like a big, a school had let out in England. There's like almost like a summer vacation in America. And a lot of the actors had gone away on vacation, and we only had a handful of actors to choose from. And I was a bit nervous. And then when I wasn't finding anybody that fit the mold, and then he walked in the door, and I was like, he was nervous. He was new. He was innocent, but he had this weird look in his eye. Mm-hmm. And I just said, this is the kid. And then I made him read on tape, and everybody looked at it and said, he's great.
Yeah. He is a real find, Jeff. A real find. Right away when he appears on screen and the whole exchange of her teacher giving a student a book and that, here, read this, I think you'll like it. So many of us in school, we had teachers like that. Here, I think you'll like this, trying to help the student out. But it's just the way that he takes the book and doesn't want to let go of the book. It's just all these little things. Judah does an amazing job as Andrew. But now you have all of these great puzzle pieces put together, and then you turn it over to Douglas Kreis, your editor. I am so in love with Douglas's work. I have been forever. What the two of you have found with the balance and the pacing here is what hammers this home and makes it so effective as a thriller. and has you, you know, on the edge of your seat and ultimately jumping out of your seat.
I know Doug would be excited to hear that. He's been with me for almost every movie I've ever done. And unfortunately or fortunately for him, I don't know. Sometimes I call him and he says, "Really?
I am
that
so
small of a film?" And I say, "Yes." And then he says, "All right, I'll do it." And then I call him with a bigger movie like The Hill or something I'm doing in the future here. And then he gets excited. But he always puts 110% into anything he does. He's just a natural born editor. He's a guy that was born to be in the little black box with a, you know, editing system in front of him. And he just becomes, you know, what I love about him too is he's always very careful about making anything sentimental or sappy or, you know, just too schmaltzy. He veers away from that. He keeps me on track with that stuff. So that's a huge plus, you know, that working with him too.
I mean, I have loved his work. I mean, I think the minute I hear Doug's name, it's like Arbitrage, Kill the Irishman, Spring Breakers, working with Harmony. Yeah. Harmony, that in and of itself is an experience. And that film
is just
batshit crazy.
Yeah,
but
it is. I went to this rough cut of Spring Breakers. He brought in five directors to look at it, and I'm sitting there with Harmony in the theater, going, "What do I even say?" Like, it's amazing.
I mean, you've got Harmony and you got Franco in it, so that kind of sums it up right there. And Doug just,
right there.
You know, he just went for it with the editing. And then I look at something like Gold that he did, so underrated by people. I love that movie.
Me too.
Oh, my God. And then The Ice Road, that had me on tenterhooks. Dope Sick, that whole series was just off the charts. So Doug is like, he is a master. So I'm curious how long this editing process was for the two of you to find the balance and the pacing, because the pacing is so well structured to really build that tension, build and play on that ambiguity.
Well, I have an easy answer for you. There wasn't a lot of choices for him. I covered it as much as I could, but at the same time, there just weren't a ton of choices. So it actually went together. Like, I'll tell you about Doug. Doug, normally when he works with a director, I've been told this by many people, the director may have like seven notes on the rough cut.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie usually is right around what the rough cut is.
Okay.
And that's the same way I work with Doug. I used to sit in the editing room and sneak back in at night when the editor went home and recut things. I was a maniac. And when I met Doug, I don't even do anything other than send him notes from home. And I live in Florida, and I edited the movie from my computer in Florida with Doug in California. And we worked that way together. And so I would look at cuts, certain scenes, and I would call him up, and we'd get on this certain system that he has that allows us to do it together. And we'd talk through it for a few hours, and then he would go back to work, and I would call him 3 days later. You know, he's just a master. I mean, you almost don't have to recut the movie once. Doug's rough cuts are like almost a finished movie.
Wow.
Nobody can believe it. But when he does it and they sit in front of it and see it, they say, "Oh, my God, this guy is a genius."
Yeah.
But he really is.
You know, the pacing is just so well done here. So you really take us on a ride, and we go up. And you're biting your nails, and it's like, you know, oh, my God. And then something happens. You give us one twist. This is so elevated from the book. That's something that I love, is that you have elevated this experience beyond the book. And
I hate to be redundant or sound I don't know. I could just tell you that was a goal of mine, majorly. When I read the book, I thought, I'm going to make this movie very scary. I added the bathtub scene in. I got a little resistance about that through certain people I won't go into right now, but I added that in and a couple other things, and I just wanted to elevate it, like you said. I wanted to make it I mean, believe me, if I had full reign on this movie and really could have done what I wanted to do with time and money, it would have been a little bit different movie. It would have been a lot scarier in certain places and things. But I felt it for what, you know what I love about the movie? That families can watch it. It's not gory. It's not a horror movie. It's a thrill. It's a psychological thriller like the old Hitchcock
films.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's
it's exactly. palatable. But it's also, people I know that don't like scary movies go, I'm not going to watch your movie. I go, you can watch it. You'll be scared. You may not want to go to sleep alone at night, but you're not going to be grossed out or horrified
right.
or feel like you shouldn't have watched it.
Yeah.
And that's the best review I can give it to people.
You know, you don't need blood and guts and gore to be scared out of your wits. And it's that whole, you know, Hitchcock had said, you know, what you don't see is a lot scarier. And this is where your renovation room really plays in. What we don't see, what we imagine, what, mm-hmm. you know, other people might be imagining, you know, that's a lot scarier.
Oh, yeah.
So you don't need the blood and guts and gore. Now, the mm-hmm. last piece of your puzzle here is actually Nathan Halpern's score. I'm a big fan of Nathan's. Emily the Criminal, you know, from Emily the Criminal to like the Martha Mitchell Effect. And then I just watched Coup that he also scored. And now Blackwater Lane. Nathan is very diverse as a composer. So I'm curious what you were looking for musically. Because something that I'm so happy the two of you did not do, you did not have score leading us. You know.
Right.
That does not happen here. The score is mm-hmm. an undercurrent versus taking us and pulling us by with a rope around our neck saying, okay, this is going to be scarier. Okay, this is, you can breathe now. There is nothing worse with a score than
oh, yeah.
when that happens.
That was the idea. Although on these kind of movies, music is, I mean, as I told Nathan, it's hugely important.
Yeah.
It definitely, it's, I'd say it's, 40 or 50% of the movie.
Yeah.
Because you can have these all these scenes, but if you don't have the music that fits it, you know, and truthfully, Doug does a temp score mm-hmm. usually on the films I work on that lead the composer pretty much on a clear path.
Mm-hmm.
And Nathan had his own ideas about that, and we wanted to underscore it a bit and not have it in your face, like you say.
Yeah.
And that was the goal. And then I thought he did a fantastic job.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really like the score that goes with this one on every level, Jeff. This is such a well-made film.
I'm now your biggest fan, okay?
Hey, you just asked...
Because you analyzed it and you saw things that you saw things that I actually did achieve. And I felt I wanted to achieve, and you felt I did. That's important to me. I mean, there's a lot about the movie I'm not happy with because there's a lot of it was out of my hands in certain ways I won't go into. But I really am really happy that you watched it and you had this reaction because that's all that matters to me. If I can get through to people in that way, that's my goal. You know, I just wanted to make a very interesting, introspective. Kind of scary movie about a woman that has stuff going on in her head and you don't know what's real
mm-hmm.
because that happens. That happens in real life. Sometimes
it happens to everybody.
Like
it's like,
right.
Did I dream that or did this just really happen?
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, it's so rooted in reality. And it just, the setting, the location, you get the creepy vibe with the mansion, with the house, the stone. Right away, you see that stone. Anybody knows anything about British history and all of these huge, huge manses that are there, that have been there for hundreds of years. You see stone, you think cold, you think spooky. Then you throw us off when we get into the house and, hey, you know, this is done up, this is really nice. I could actually live here. The kitchen is functional. The plumbing works.
Right.
Not the vibe. That's not what you expect when you see the outside. So you throw us off, but you've set that. That's in our mind of seeing the stone, and you think cold. and dark. And a lot of the film is cold and dark.
Like The Front Door. The Front Door is a big part of the movie for me. I love that front door and that entrance way.
Very important part of the movie.
Mm-hmm. And so, also for me, I was not sure if people would think we shot in two different locations. And so I wanted to connect them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I hate people when they don't have a lot of money. They'll shoot singles of things, like love an actor walking down the street.
Yeah.
And then they'll cut to Paris, and then they cut back to the actor, but you can't see he's in Paris.
Yeah.
It's just a cheat that I hate. And so I wanted the audience to make sure they knew we shot inside this house and outside. It's the same house.
Yeah. I never questioned that for a minute. You had that whole very cohesive, visual cohesiveness, so you knew it was all in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Just really so well done. Just one last thing for you, Jeff, here, before I let you go.
Hey, Debbie.
What did you've been doing this for so long, but what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker in making Blackwater Lane that you can now take forward into future work?
What I learned in Blackwater Lane, that I want to shoot in England again. Yes. Number one.
Yes.
That was one of the biggest things. Also, I want to do another movie like Blackwater Lane at some point, but even on a bigger scale. I would like to have more time and more money to really achieve what I think I can. I mean, I've always felt that as a filmmaker, as a person, and a filmmaker, that I love every kind of movie. If I go to a scary movie, it's got to be real and scary. If I go to a romantic comedy, it's got to touch me in a romantic way, and it's also got to be funny and really well done. The acting's got to be good. It's got to be believable. All those things. If I do what my goal is right now, is if my company is focusing on only inspirational movies after I did The Hill.
Uh-huh.
That movie turned out really well, and it's taken me on another project that's huge. And I just want that kind of money and that kind of size to do another movie like Blackwater Lane. So to answer your one question, what I learned on that is that I don't want to do small movies much anymore. I just want a little bit more money. I don't need a ton, but enough to do the things I want to do and not be rushed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens. And look, it's not a complaint. I mean, we all know going into it what we're getting into. But as a visionary and a filmmaker, I just want to be able to have the tools I need and the time I need. You know, because a lot of people don't understand when you're working on a movie as a director and you come from an acting background, you're really about the acting more than anything and the mm-hmm. characters.
Yep.
And so when you have no time and like Minka Kelly says, can I talk to you about the scene? I'll say, yeah, you have 5 minutes. I don't say that, but I mean, that's kind of what's going on in my head
mm-hmm.
because we're behind schedule or we're on schedule, but we have a very tight schedule, whatever it is. I can't give that actor that time they need. And you know, people like Minka and Dermot and Maggie, they all know the drill. They've been there.
Yep.
So they know not to push the envelope too far on time. They're all pretty together on that. So, you know, I would just like to have more time and money and do a movie another thriller like this, but something equally as unusual in the story, but I would like to have, you know, just the tools I need financially to make it work, you know.
Well,
just more time with the cast.
Well, Jeff, here's to more time and money for your next one. I got to tell you.
Thank you. But just like sitting with Minka and Dermot and Maggie and talking about the scene, they were so into it. And when you hire actors like that, like Robert Altman taught me a great thing. One day, I was on the set of The Player. I did The Player with him, and that's how we formed a relationship. He was my mentor. And we're standing there, and Avenue Pictures came up, the executive, and they said, Bob, what an amazing job you're doing. You're so talented. You're a genius. And they walked away, and he looked at me, and he goes, what a bunch of BS. He goes, I just get my director's chair. I sit here, and I hire great actors, and I sit back and watch. That's what he said. And I knew that wasn't completely true, but what he was trying to convey to me was you hire great actors and they already know their characters and know what to do. And you just have to guide them.
Yes.
A little, you know.
Oh my
God. And without those three actors, it would have been a different movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It most definitely would have been. Jeff, this has been so fabulous having you on the show and talking with you today. I hope we get to do it again in the future. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Big one. I can't talk about it right now because it's kind of a secret, but it'll be announced in the trades in the next probably few weeks.
Well, I will be anxiously looking for it to see what wonder yeah. you're going to bring us.
Where are you located?
In L.A. In L.A.
Oh, you're in L.A. Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
Yep. But this has been such an absolute joy. And as I said, I hope we get to chat again in the future.
Absolutely. You're one of the most special people I've interviewed with, to be honest with you. Just based on your film sense and your film history, I can tell, is pretty vast. So it was nice to talk to you. You almost talk like you probably have been a filmmaker. I don't know.
I have.
I mean, you know what you're doing.
I try. Thank you so much.
We all do.
Jeff, you have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day. And hopefully we'll chat sooner rather than later.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And that was Jeff Celentano, director of Blackwater Lane. It is out now. It is streaming. It is on VOD. See it. You'll enjoy it. And now, we're going to shift gears back again, making Pam work today. And now, I gave you the whole setup for the convert and Guy Pearce's character. 19th century, 1830s, New Zealand, Maori tribes versus meet English colonists. We've got Maori versus Maori fighting with each other. Maori not wanting English colonists there. Introspective, observational. Crossing of cultures that really sends a message to everyone watching that there is a real need to listen, that a lot of differences can be resolved just by listening. So, take a listen to my exclusive interview with Guy Pearce talking about The Convert. Hi, Guy. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
Thrilled to be speaking with you again. Do you realize our last interview was in 2012 for Lockout?
Oh, wow.
I know.
Oh, wow. Very different film.
To say the least. And
well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, in Lockout, my character was sort of thrust into outer space. This was a very foreign kind of world. And in this film, my character is thrust from one end of the globe to the other into a rather foreign world. So I suppose there are some similarities.
Yeah. You just never cease to dazzle me, Guy. You have been turning out some beautiful, beautiful performances over the years since we last spoke. And, of course, I just got a kick out of your voice work in Back to the Outback, I have to tell you. I love your animated voice work. But
all of my sons, I have a 7-year-old son, so all of his friends at his school, every time I go to pick up my son, are saying, do Frank the Spider.
As well they should.
Yes, so I do Frank the Spider for them.
Oh my gosh, well you're obviously the hit on Parents Day. I have to tell you, I didn't know what to expect. I'm a huge fan of Lee's work also. So I didn't know what to expect with The Convert. And, oh my God. Number one, it's breathtaking. It's beautiful. Jin's cinematography is outstanding. But then you start watching and get into your character of Thomas Monroe. And the very introspective and observational balance that you bring to him and seeing this world through his eyes is just incredible. And to watch what Thomas goes through, especially with his charge, Teoriori, her character, just magical watching this unfold. What led you, besides the chance you get to work with Lee, what led you to saying yes to The Convert?
Well, firstly, thank you for your lovely comments. It's very kind of you. I really, I mean, all of what you just pointed out then, in fact, was very much the reason for doing the film. The introspection, the trauma that this character has experienced, and his now sort of lifeline that he's been thrown, and taking, you know, this sort of new opportunity in life to rebuild himself, as it were, was all stuff that I found very interesting when Lee called me about this film, and he talked me through it before I got to read the script. So I got a pretty clear image from him of what it was he was going to make, and I said, Lee, of course I'm going to do this. This sounds incredible, and I'm on board. And you know, as you pointed out, you know, to get to work with Lee, of course, is a bit of a dream come true. And we've talked about working together for years, and have never really managed to do it. So there were a number of aspects. I love playing characters who have a story going on internally that they don't necessarily vocalise, or when they do vocalise, that it's you know, either done. You know, either done in sort of repressed, difficult, awkward ways, or they finally speak up about it, and it's beautifully articulate. And you know, I think to get to express one's internal engine as an actor is everything. So I was already on board just because of that. And then, of course, the setting of this film, where it's set, and being sort of thrust into this world that this character of mine does not really know at all. And for me as an actor, I know a little about Maori culture. My father was from New Zealand, and, you know, I have an inkling about some of it, but nothing to this extent. So that in itself was a wonderful and you know, really inspiring part of this whole journey too. So there was a lot about it that really drew me in. It was one of those jobs where you just go, yep, no question, I'm on board.
You've done a lot of jobs like that with characters that are very multi-textured, very complex. And Thomas is also, he's very complex. And I love the range of emotion that you take us on. The stoicism that we see in really the first half of the film, moving into the third act of the film, and then that emotional breakdown or breakthrough is just phenomenal to watch. So much power is in that transformation. Is that difficult for you to go on an emotional journey like that with a character?
It's difficult it's difficult on a number of reasons, because you're, you know, mining those depths within yourself, and so it's hard, it's exhausting, it can be overwhelming at times, but at the same time, all of that stuff is also the great challenge. It's exciting to find it. It's exciting to try and do it successfully. It used to be much more difficult for me years ago, when I didn't trust myself as much, because I felt I had to hold all that stuff very presently in my mind, thinking that I was going to kind of forget stuff if I let it go. So that was doubly exhausting. And as I, you know, over the past 20, 30 years have trusted my ability as an actor to step in and out of what's required on camera, I'm able to actually just park things and literally be on set and have a chat to another actor when camera's not rolling. You know, as long as I get a little minute or two to kind of get the thing back off the shelf and inhabit it again before camera's rolling, then I'm okay. And in a way, a lot better, because you step back into it sort of fresh, whereas in the old days I would, as I say, sort of hang on to things for fear of losing it, and in a way wasn't necessarily any better, because maybe I'd sort of exhausted myself even off camera before I then got back on camera again. So I manage it all better now. So is it difficult? It's easier than it used to be, but it's difficult for the things that I initially said, in that you're going, right, I've got to dig deep here. I've got to feel some heavy feelings, which is fine. You know, I'm happy to feel those feelings, but, and I love doing it. I love trying to move an audience with deep emotions, because I do think one of the things that I find interesting about filmmaking is that we as audience members are carrying all sorts of stuff that we're either conscious about and are repressing, or we're not even conscious of. And I think as an actor, as a performer, you can perhaps unlock some things for people. Not to suggest that I cure them or I help them find resolution or whatever, but to kind of go on a journey together, because audience members feel trauma, they feel terrible past experiences that they've had, and to be able to walk through that stuff with compassion and with honour and with respect hopefully enables an audience member to sort of do the same and perhaps have a bit of a look at themselves, even in the most subconscious or minimal way. So, and I know as an audience member myself, when I watch something, Anthony Hopkins can just do one little turn and a look or a little gesture with his hand, and I'm undone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm absolutely undone, because it takes me back to something of my own. And so, you know, to be able to express multi-layers is really the be-all and end-all for me. That's why I find, you know, yeah, I mean, not that I do really big action films or anything like that, but if a lot of that stuff that where the excitement of the story is about the colour and movement as opposed to what's going on internally for the characters, then I'm not particularly interested. And I just go, okay, well, we can blow that thing up, but I'd rather just look at a close-up of that girl's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That'll tell me a lot more, you know.
And as you say that, I'm thinking of so many of your performances, such as in The Last Vermeer. And that's
right.
Very much you. It's just one look, one turn, one movement into a shadow under a window holding a paintbrush. And it very much is what's going on in the mind.
That's the beauty of filmmaking, too. You know, the camera comes in really close. You can do the most subtle, you know, you can barely do anything sometimes. But if the intention is there, the camera captures it.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Now, with a character like Thomas Monroe, I know time and place, setting is always very important, production design. For the most part, this is one of the sparsest sets of any of your films, I think. You've got, granted, you've got Mother Nature there, which is just beautiful, and I could watch footage of you and that gorgeous white horse just walking on the beach forever. It's so stunning.
Yeah.
But right. How important is it, particularly in a film like that, this, with the sparsity of setting, to put you in the time and place that you need to be in?
Well, it's everything. It feels like it's everything to me. I mean, I sit there with the script and go through my conversations with Lee early on, and we sit in a boardroom of a production office and, you know, get shown photographs of locations and sort of intellectually put all the pieces together, and I go home at night and learn my lines and find those feelings that I'm looking for and kind of cobble everything together. And then you walk out onto the beach and you go, ah, there it is. Ah, yeah. And then I can just let it all go, and all that cobbling that I've done and all that intellectual work that is necessary. It's necessary to sort of slowly sort of sew all those pieces together, weave all those pieces together. But that's all they are at that point. They're just pieces, even if they're pieces of true emotions, they're just pieces that I'm just weaving together in a sort of a quilt. And then you walk out onto the beach and you forget you've even got the quilt, and it just all comes, you know. It's really, it's wonderful, because then also as an actor, you let go and you don't overact and you just stand there and you're carrying all of the stuff you've thought about, and the setting and the scenery and what the art department have done is, and your costume, etc., is doing so much work for you. So it's a great collaboration, I think, what we do as actors and what everyone else does. But, the sense, I was struggle a little bit with the whole idea that, actors are the kind of ones to focus on. I get why, because we're the ones on camera, but so is the background, so is the costume, so is everything else, so is the movement of the camera. You know, everyone's hand is just as important as everyone else's. And I feel that when I'm there on set. I know that, absolutely, for sure.
The Maori language. How much of it did you have to learn, Guy, for this role? And how much could you understand within the dialogue of the story?
I couldn't understand any of it, to be honest. I really had to sort of look on the page of what was being said, looking at the translation, and I just had to learn what you hear me say in the film. It's a very difficult language to learn as a newbie, and I have to shout out to Jackie McKenzie for what the work she did when it comes to that language. She was incredible, I have to say.
Guy, a beautiful, beautiful film and performance. And it truly, I love it dearly. And I'm so thrilled you were able to take time and talk to me today. We can't wait 12 years before we chat again.
Well, thank you, Debbie. Wonderful to talk to you again. I really appreciate it. And yes, let's not wait 12 years next time.
Thank you, Guy. Have a wonderful day.
All right, you too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was my exclusive interview with Guy Pearce talking about The Convert. And a lot of great morsels and nuggets in our conversation about his acting process and character. I think he's just fabulous. I always have. And he is such a joy. But all right, that is all the time we have today. Yes, we went over again, as per usual. But I don't know what we're doing next week. I have people going, tentative. Talent might be available. They might be flying. I'm waiting for confirmations. So that's where we're at. But until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.